Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. At ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, there are many ways we support soldiers, veterans and their immediate families. Sometimes by direct assistance, and on other occasions, through the work of other organisations, by making grants and donations. In this edition of General Talk, my guests are Waterloo Uncovered, a brilliant charity who do great things for the injured and victims of PTSD. In this rather special programme, it was my privilege to speak with CEO and co-founders Mark Evans, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Foynette, Professor Tony Pollard from Glasgow University, and veterans Rachel Willis and Sean Douglas, who explain the fascinating story of a unique charity who achieved great things for veterans and their welfare with little more than a pick, trowel and tape measure. I hope you enjoy the programme.
Mark, it's great to see you and your team here today. Waterloo Uncovered describes itself as a world-class archaeology project with the Veteran Support Programme. How did the idea come about?
It was the year before the bicentenary of Waterloo in 2015. And Charlie Foynette was asked, by his commanding officer, to arrange a battlefield tour for the Coalition Guards to visit the Waterloo battlefield, to go and have a good look at how we single-handedly saved the day and turned the Napoleonic tide back in 1815. Charlie and I should add, prior to being in the army, we studied archaeology together at university and had long been looking for ways to do archaeology. And this opportunity arose, and it wasn't just an opportunity to get soldiers involved in archaeology. It really was an opportunity to get some of the injured guys from battalions, so to get them out and to get them to do something a little bit different, and to tell the world about it and learn more about the Battle of Waterloo at the same time.
Archaeology is a very left of field area to come from. Charlie, what made you suddenly think this is a good idea?
There were other organisations, notably Operation Nightingale, doing archaeology on the military estate with injured personnel who were going through the recovery process. And I think we saw that as something that was an interesting model. Archaeology is a wonderfully multidisciplinary subject. So there is something almost for anybody. And crucially, when it comes to what we do, it is accessible to people of almost all physical abilities. There's a huge supporting cast to the person with the trowel in the trench. And because we don't have, certainly at Waterloo and indeed our other sites, we don't have any of the commercial pressures that come with proper grown-up field archaeology out there in the real world. Nobody's trying to build a motorway through the site. There is no imperative to get everything done right now. It allows us to take our time and essentially to tailor the work to the ability of the people doing it. So it's uniquely suitable. It also comes as a group activity and one that takes place outside in all weathers. And in that respect, I think it has close parallels to military service, because you work as a team. There is, generally speaking, not much mercy between archaeologists. So the banter and general sort of atmosphere on site is often quite reminiscent of the things that people miss about the army. So it really has an awful lot of crossovers.
What was it that made you think there might be something to do? How are you going to go about getting this project off the ground?
I think we got very lucky, Harry. We put together a particularly good team, not least Tony Pollard, who is one of the sort of foremost battlefield archaeologists in the world. We'd also found that there was archaeology at Waterloo, which was something of a godsend, to say the least. But the reality is you're looking for 12 hours in the day in a field. It's not like you're looking for the foundations you might find at Pompeii. But I think most of all, what we saw was, and you can speak to Sean Douglas, who was there, will tell you about this. It undoubtedly had a positive effect on the soldiers and veterans who had taken part in that first excavation, and that was what spurred us on. I was medically discharged with post-traumatic stress, and I was lucky enough to have and my friends, family, and a considerable amount of support around me. Not everybody else is. And this was our opportunity, as well as to do the archaeology, to provide a level of support for a group of people in a way that was fun and interesting to us and to them.
You are a quad erat demonstrandum of how Waterloo uncovered the beneficial effects of archaeology. What for you is the thing that really makes you feel good about yourself and put that spring in Mark Evans's step?
For me, like I said, it's an opportunity to give back. I won't lie as well. I studied archaeology at university, and it's something I find fascinating and I enjoy doing. So there is a natural interest. For many of the others, like Charlie said, what they get out of it, I think probably above and beyond, is a sense of belonging and a sense of purpose. They're involved in a project that has real meaning. They, as I said, are providing real assistance with both the excavation and the interpretation. The teamwork, the camaraderie, archaeologists like soldiers are used to working in adverse conditions. They have a dark sense of humour. They're used to getting on with it. There's a real sense of achievement throughout the whole project, not just in unearthing the detail, not just unearthing the new stories about what happened at the battle and how we changing the course of history, but digging a trench, finishing that. There's something really satisfying in finishing a bit of work on a day-to-day basis. And quite a lot of people who, for one reason or another, have fallen off of the traditional path and are maybe suffering from PTSD or other mental health issues, they need a little bit of help and direction to help them move forward, and that's what we do. And so for me, it's the support of the veterans that gets me out of bed every morning.
Professor Tony Pollard, you were sitting presumably in your splendid suite of rooms up in Glasgow University. and pondering the problems of international archaeology, and then you get a call from these two army officers saying they want to set up a charity and they're going to base it around archaeology. What happened next?
Well, I was invited down to the barracks in London with Buckingham Palace basically outside of the window, and we just had a conversation, and they basically said, well, how would you feel about doing the archaeology at Waterloo? And given that Waterloo is an iconic battlefield, it's probably one of the world's most famous, there was no way I could say no, really. But the major appeal for me, and this might sound as something of a surprise from an archaeologist, was the opportunity to work with veterans. Because I had spent, by then, by 2014, I'd spent time with military veterans, including Harry Patch, who was the last man to have fought in the First World War. And in 2008, I went to Flanders with Harry as part of his entourage, so he could unveil a monument to where he went over the top at the Battle of Passchendaele. And spending 3 days in his company on the battlefields of Flanders was a phenomenal experience. But the point was that at that time, Harry was 110 years old. He lived to be 111, but that, when he died, I realized that we'd lost a living link to a really important part of our history there. And archaeology and history at that point become much more important. And the responsibility is on us to make sure that the past is remembered and remembered in the right way. I also started working and rubbing shoulders with Falklands veterans and attending workshops, largely at the University of Nottingham. Looking at the 1982 conflict. So veterans were very much on my mind. And when Charlie and Mark came up with this great idea and they said, you know, how about Waterloo plus working with veterans? It was a no-brainer. There was no way I could say no. And I one of my favorite moments of that meeting was we were even at the point of coming up with a name for what was to become a charity. And Charlie suggested Waterloo Underground. And I thought, I still think that still brings a smile to my face. But we settled on Waterloo Uncovered. And the rest, as they say, is history. And some of us here, including Sean, went out to Waterloo during the Easter, I think, of 2015, just before all of the razzmatazz of the 200th anniversary. And we did, with a very small team, and we did a very small pilot. And we were basically examining the opportunities there and seeing whether there was archaeology for a start. One of the appeals for me was that there had been very little, if any, archaeology done on the actual battlefield. Some amateur metal detecting, but no formal project. So it was very important that before we cast the die and got a lot of people involved, that we established that this was viable. And we did. And it was a wonderful week or so that we spent there. And then we returned with a bigger team in July of 2015. And that was the first of our annual two-week seasons. And we would go back with a large team of archaeologists. I take students. We have students from the continent. Historians, you name it, and it's grown and grown. And we would spend two blissful weeks during the summer doing the archaeology across the battlefield. But that was, of course, until 2019, where we really by then got our act together. The project was working like a well-oiled machine, and the archaeology was phenomenal. And then all of a sudden, COVID hit, and we haven't been back since. But we're all, I think, after a two-year hiatus, very excited about the prospect of going back there this summer. And in some respects, the two-year break has probably done us good. We're all refreshed and raring to go.
Why, when Waterloo is almost in living memory, does the battlefield need to be dug up when many may say it is as consecrated as a grave in that sense?
Well, I think the point about conflict archaeology is, and I remember first voicing my desire to move into battlefield archaeology, which has kind of grown into the wider field of conflict archaeology. And people ask that question, what's the point of doing the archaeology of the First World War or the Second World War, and indeed now the Falklands War? But the point is that archaeology is a unique way of engaging with the past. I always say it's the closest we have to a time machine. We can't stand in the boots of those people who fought in these conflicts. But when you're on the battlefield at Waterloo and you've excavated a musket ball and you're the first person to have held that since the soldier that fired it in 1815, it's a phenomenal connection with the past. So there's that visceral element. And I think that feeds into the idea of well-being. But there's also the academic side of things. History isn't always right as written. And as it was Wellington himself who said, you might as well write the Battle of a Ball, i.e. a dance, as a battle, because it's just a confusing melee. And you have no idea in the fog of war, in that black powder smoke, of knowing what's happening anywhere other than a few feet away from you. So that the accounts, as we know, come from many perspectives, vary in their shades of accuracy. But what archaeology can do through looking at the terrain, through surviving features, through the artifacts and indeed graves, is add a degree of objectivity and an extra dimension to those accounts and to all of those books. And as we all know, there are libraries written on Waterloo.
But in that sense, I understand that, because much of the battlefield of Waterloo has been changed in that presumably a lot of the good stuff, as they say, has been looted over the centuries beforehand. And secondly, with that great mound that the Belgians dug behind, how much did that change the topography of the battlefield itself?
That has changed the topography. The battlefield as we see it today, and you can see this to some degree in contemporary paintings and drawings of the battlefield, the relief has been smoothed out to a degree. The slopes are shallower than they were. The sunken roadways, in some cases, have entirely disappeared. I mean, if you're up there on Wellington's position, close to the mound, there is no sign of that very deep, what became a trench, which was an integral part of Wellington's defence, because it's all been scoured away. But nonetheless, this is, well, it's a small battlefield considering the number of men that actually fought on it. But it's 2.5 miles by 2.5 miles. So there is a lot of well-preserved territory there. And understanding how it's changed is important. And archaeology has the means to allow us to do that. And at present, we're doing a very widespread geophysical survey, which allows us a snapshot of what's happening underground or what has happened underground. And that would be very important in a very important inroad into understanding topographic change, but also identifying features that are no longer there, including graves. And so it's an incredible landscape within which to work. Its appeal is added to by the fact that the Belgians, we're in the state of Wallonia, have very tight conservation laws. And Waterloo, as you rightly say, has changed over time. And it was Wellington himself who said, when he saw the mound dedicated to the Prince of Orange, who said, "They've ruined my battlefield." He had a strong sense of ownership, that man. But the point is that, you know, since the 1820s, that battlefield is pretty well preserved. I would contest that if it was in the UK, it would be nowhere near as well preserved as it is. So that again was a great appeal for archaeology. And I think we have definitely now, we're very happy that we have added to our understanding of what happened there on that day.
So Mark, not just turn up with a set of trousers and say, "Right, here we are, lads." How do you go about setting up an archaeological dig on the battlefield of Waterloo?
As I remember it, we resorted to good old-fashioned etiquette, as we were taught at Sandhurst, and wrote a rather nice letter asking people whether it'd be okay if we came and did some work on their land. And funnily enough, the Belgian government said, "Oh, we've never had a letter asking us something we can do before," and promptly agreed. They also not only agreed, but they asked if they could get involved, because we were all set up to help them out. They'd never actually been able to really do any archaeology at Waterloo before, because their archaeological sort of team and capacity is rather stretched, running around after building sites and building works and sort of looking after emergency stuff.
We work with this wonderful Belgian archaeologist called Dominic Bosque, who is the sort of who runs the sort of local regional archaeology team, and I went to meet Dom to chat about the potential of this project. We had a good chat. Dom is a fascinating archaeologist, not least because this really isn't his period. He prefers people who died at least 3,000 years ago. But in terms of the sort of limited canon of archaeology on the battlefield at Waterloo, Dom performed one of the most interesting pieces of work, I think, that pre-existed Waterloo Uncovered, which was recovery of a skeleton that was discovered when they were doing test trenches to clear the site for the car park, what is now the car park behind the visitor centre. They found a skeleton of what turned out to be, we think, a Hanoverian soldier from King's German Legion. And it's a wonderful piece of archaeology and a real piece of sort of archaeological detective work to work out the origins of this soldier from the objects he had with him. And that's pretty much the only... I think that was one of the things that really demonstrated the potential of archaeology on this site. And when we went with part of the battalion, I recall going to the museum where the remains are displayed, which again is something in archaeology that perhaps is a controversial discussion point. But where the remains are displayed, and I remember talking with one of my soldiers and saying, "Right, well, what do you think killed him?" And he said, "Well, it's obvious, sir, he hasn't got a head." Which was entirely true, but what I was hoping he would see would be the musket ball in his ribcage, rather than the fact that the digger had taken away half his skull. But it's a wonderful piece of archaeology, and of course Dom is a sort of leading light of the whole project, and he's the one that liaises with the local farmers, charms everybody, and keeps us straight. And without him, I think we would struggle to do any of the things we do.
You talk about soldiers, but actually this is. Tri-service, all veterans are welcome to the programme, is that correct?
Yeah, the definition, as you know, of veteran, the British context, is anybody who has spent one day in uniform. But yeah, we have very deliberately set the lens as wide as we possibly can, because often there's a whole cohort of people out there, particularly those who are injured very early in their careers, and find themselves ejected from this organisation that they expected and planned to devote their lives to. That alone, the adjustment of leaving under those circumstances when you don't plan to, can be very difficult. And you know, for that reason, we wanted to include just as many people as sort of were part of that community as we could. And of course, we don't wish this just to be a British sport, just like the Battle of Waterloo. It was multinational. And of course, all the campaigns in which certainly most of my generation have participated have been, you know, a multinational affair as well. So it all fits rather nicely.
Rachel, how did you get involved with Waterloo Uncovered? And what was your first impressions when you turned up to get involved in an archaeology project? It was quite unmilitary intelligence-like, isn't it?
There are some similarities. You can use your skills that you've learnt over a period of time. But I first got involved by meeting another veteran on another course with another charity who talked about it. And I had done a Nightingale dig in the local area. I'd always been interested in archaeology, but never got into it, and obviously never had the time while serving. And I had been signed off sick from work, so I was still in the army, but not being employed. And the opportunity came, and I applied for it, and before I knew it, I was out there at Waterloo. But my first image is meeting everybody down in London and seeing the myriad of people there. I could immediately spot the veterans, the squaddies, and then there was all these random archaeologists and their students, and I was still not ready for that world.
I mean, how many people were we talking about going on an archaeological dig?
Well, obviously you've got the people participating, but then there's all the support staff as well. So it was quite a few. I'd say, I don't know, there was about 30, 40 of us that met down in London before we all got together. And so it was an eclectic bunch, you could definitely say that. But I was looking forward to it. I was, you know, it was anticipation and anxiety. So I was early stages of my diagnosis of mental illness on top of physical ailments that I have as well, which inevitably led me to be medically discharged at my 21-year point.
What was your view about going on an archaeological dig?
The way I describe it is it was a game changer for me and my mental mindset at the time. It made me realise that I was still a person of worth and value, and that, you know, there were possibilities for my future. So, and I think you can take the archaeology, it's almost the structure that supports Waterloo Uncovered. Even before you go on the dig itself, and then progression afterwards, they don't just abandon you after the dig. I think you can apply that to a lot of things as well. You know, you can almost take out the archaeology and insert something else. It just works. It's that whole structure that they have with support and, as I say, progression as well.
Mark, you've got an archaeological dig going on. You've also got injured veterans. How do you ensure that the veterans are cared for and not just left to dig big holes in the battlefields?
I think it's safe to say that a significant amount of the care actually is undertaken by the archaeologists, because they treat the veterans as equals and bring them into the project. That isn't to say that there isn't a good deal of work that goes on behind the scenes and before and after. And I think that the well-being support that we provide is what you would definitely describe as soft touch. It's there. We spend a lot of time at the beginning of a program, and bear in mind that when veterans come on board with us these days, they're actually with us for almost a year. So we take a lot of time to get to know them, to bring them into the project, to get them to understand a little about the archaeology and the world they're going into. We even ask them to do some fundraising. We sit down with them and we work out their individual goals and aims. Because every veteran is absolutely different. And some person's goal might be to do with their recovery, might be to do with physical and mental injury. It could also be that they're looking to get some advice or get some direction with education or indeed employment. So we look at everybody as an individual. We then take them on the activity that they're involved with. As we're talking about here about the excavation. But these days, we also run a finds program as well, as well as a virtual program that we developed during COVID. And then we take great care once they've been with us on that activity to look after them and work and help them move towards the next place that they're going. And that could be, that's a variety of directions for people. That could be towards a recruiter, towards a job opportunity. That could be back to the charity, another charity that's looking to provide them with some support. In some cases, that is to go on to university, to go on to be archaeologists. In all cases, it's to continue as part of the Waterloo Uncovered family, and we're very careful to provide people with this enduring support that is, again, soft touch, because this isn't about dependency, but it is about people belonging to something. I think one of the testaments to that that we've seen over the period of COVID lockdown in particular is I've been absolutely amazed. I've been delighted to hear the stories that have trickled in constantly about the number of people who've met on our projects that have supported each other throughout this period. Friendships that were made in trenches in Waterloo that have been enduring, and as Rachel said, have been absolutely, absolutely life-changing. You know, we're not about big numbers at Waterloo Uncovered, and this year we'll be looking to help about 100 veterans. But we put a lot of time and effort into each veteran as an individual to make sure that they get the most out of the opportunity.
Do you think it is fair of the armed forces to discharge their personnel when they've been mentally damaged as a result of the work they do on behalf of the country and the nation?
I think that's the role of charities, and always has been the role of charities. There's a strong history of that going back to the days of King Charles and the Royal Hospital Chelsea. Regimental associations have been looking after their soldiers, be they wounded or not, their veterans, after they've left for a very, very long time. I do believe there is a very strong network of charities and organisations within the United Kingdom that supports its veterans very admirably. And it's really, your eyes are opened up when you do start to work internationally and you see how the support that is offered in the UK is considerably more advanced than it is in a number of other countries. It's great to see the way that there is more focus on veterans within the government these days, and there is a really real effort, quite clearly, to actually provide that continuity that veterans need once they leave the military, lining them up to go and be supported by the NHS or providing with the care that they need.
I just wonder, do you think we are overly sensitive to PTSD and that everybody seems to be finding it at front and centre? Is that a good thing?
I think it can only be a good thing if people are waking up to and recognising issues to do with mental health, because it can only be a good thing if people find support and find the help that they need to carry on leading their lives in the way that they can. PTSD is, I think, is over the last few years has maybe become a bit of a catch-all term within the sort of military community, to an umbrella term for mental health. And I think our friends from King's University would be quite quick to point out that clinical PTSD isn't necessarily as common as I think some of the red top papers would like us to believe, but it is without a doubt a terrible thing. It is something that afflicts our soldiers and is something that we can do something about. Having suffered from PTSD myself, I can attest to that and how it tore my life apart for a number of years on my return from Afghanistan. It's not something I would wish upon anyone else. So it is good that we talk about it. The service that veterans give is something that can cause distress and harm in later life, and that's something that we should be talking about. And if we can help, every time we help one person, we're making the world a better place.
Sean, if you didn't mind asking, when you went on your first dig with Waterloo Uncovered, what sort of state were you in?
I was in a pretty rough place because I'd just been told I was going to be medically discharged, and I stood outside Major Foynette's at the time office 45 minutes while he was on the phone to Mark to let him know that I was going to be discharged. And he asked me, did I know what I was going to do? And I had no idea. And after he had just been on the call with Mark talking about the project, and he offered me a position on the dig. So I took it with open mind, open arms, and I was hesitant, but the more time I spent with the people, and understanding what the outcome of the project was trying to do. It changed my mindset. And
somewhat interrupt us here. You were injured in Afghanistan. In your specific case, you weren't even fighting for your own country. It must have been particularly hard for you because you'd come from South Africa, if I recall correctly.
I had made the decision, still in South Africa, that I was going to join the British Army. So that was always in my decision-making. And I had the opportunity to not go to Afghan. I made the decision to go. So I can't be upset that I was injured and blame anybody else, because the decision were mine. My reservations come post-injury at some of the lack of support I got, which allowed my injury to cascade into what it became.
How did your involvement with the Diggins, how did that help you in your recovery and rehabilitation?
It put me back in a situation with like-minded people. It also showed me that I'm not as useless or as unable as I once thought I was. So it did give me the motivation to continue.
I'd like to pick up on a point, Rachel, that you made. I think that that a lot of the care and the welfare and the support comes from the archaeological team. Tony, how does an archaeologist know how to deal with someone with mental welfare issues?
Well, I think one of the points that's coming out of this discussion is that we're all used to working with teams and in teams and collaborating and helping one another out. And by the time we got to Waterloo, I'd been leading archaeological teams for, 20 years plus. And I think whether that person is an injured ex-service member, a veteran with PTSD, or a student who's got worries at home, we have empathy. We know how to care for people. I've had teams in very different, very difficult circumstances where there's been a lot of pressure. Waterloo is, as Charlie has said, is a very luxurious project in that we don't have the pressures of a motorway being built or the site about to disappear under a new building. But I've been on projects where those pressures plus others. I mean, for instance, when I was working on the Western Front site of Fromelles in 2007, 2008, and we were looking for and found the mass graves of Australian soldiers who'd been buried by the Germans in 1916. That was a hugely high pressured job with international press, the British and Australian governments all very carefully monitoring what was going on, working in tandem with the Australian military. And that put all of us under a great deal of pressure, along with the emotional side of uncovering the bodies of young men who had died in battle under the most horrendous circumstances. And we looked after one another. And all of those who were on that team all those years ago still regard one another with a great deal of warmth. And you almost become a family. And the parallels here, again, as Sean was saying, are very close to the military. And so I'm not trained in any form of therapy or well-being, but I know I feel comfortable in the company of veterans, and recently had that privileged in the Falklands with two veterans of 1982. And it's a two-way street. It's very much a two-way street, and we gain a lot from one another.
Do you think the Army and the Armed Forces have learned from Waterloo Uncovered?
Absolutely. I mean, we are actually currently in a conversation with the armed forces and the recovery chain about how they can use Waterloo Uncovered as a part of their recovery pathway going forward. So they definitely see the benefit in what we do, and that's why they've been providing soldiers or serving personnel to come on our projects for the past 7 years now.
And Rachel, your background was in military intelligence. Did you ever think you'd end up digging holes in the ground on battlefields?
No, I must admit, I didn't have much experience of that apart from in training and promotion courses. So, it was slightly different As I said before, a lot of the skills you learn in the military, you then, you know, you realise that they are transferable. You know, you can use them in archaeology and many other aspects of life. So that's another bonus.
Harry, it sort of cuts to a point that you made earlier about when and how we discharge people. I think Sean, if you'll forgive me, Sean, Sean's case is an interesting one. Because he was of where he was in the recovery process, we weren't actually able to give him much to do in terms of military duties and life in the barracks. So this point about leaving the things you know and the organisation in which you serve, one of the problems that we see across the board with people who are injured is the process of being injured and rehabilitation is itself quite isolating. And, you know, within the army is obviously a very sort of forward-looking, operationally focused organisation. And when people are unable to participate in the normal business of the army, that itself tends to cause isolation. Of course, one of the problems we have, and perhaps it's a good problem to have, is that the army tends to take the view that we shouldn't discharge people until they are as recovered as we can make them within the process and system.
We've got on this podcast, we've got two people who are in a very serious bad place, and yet still the armed forces discharge them. So therefore, I would say the armed forces have not done their duty in terms of duty of care to their personnel.
Well, you may very well be right. You know, there is possibly a rather brutal element where the army then makes a decision about at which point the army has gone as far as it can go on the treatment pathway, and it should then devolve to somebody else. Now, you know, it's not for me to say where that line should be drawn, but certainly I think one of the things that we can offer within our project, and I hope this was the case with Sean, is being able to give people, wherever they sit in that recovery pathway, some meaningful activity whereby they are once again part of a team in which they can play a full part. And certainly I found as a company commander, one of the things that was of greatest concern was the fact that we couldn't involve certain people in everything we were doing. And that worry you have that you are unintentionally creating isolation, you know, simply because, you know, you can't take people out and get them involved in training. And that's a real difficulty when managing injured soldiers.
What was the point, Mark, where you suddenly realised that this perhaps one time archaeological dig had legs and was going to move forward into something far bigger than what it is now?
I think probably the point in time where I realised that we really were onto something was during the summer, during our very first summer excavation, where there was a coal streamer, a double amputee who was excavating with us. He was outside. He was in a trench working in the killing zone outside of Hougoumont Farm, and he uncovered a musket ball, which looked like it was a British musket ball, and looked like it had been fired, and looked like it had hit something, which is something we found out afterwards once we'd had a chance to look at it. But his immediate reaction, as far as we could see, was to burst into tears. And once we'd sort of gone over to him and talked through what had happened, what he explained had happened to him in a nanosecond was really quite phenomenal. He said his first reaction holding this musket ball was that this was a basketball that had been fired by a fellow Colchian guard 200 years beforehand, another soldier that he drew a connection to, and he felt immensely proud to be the first person to have unearthed and held this musketball. He then thought, aha, and this is something that's hit one of those Frenchies as they were trying to climb over the walls, and it might have taken a big chunk out of one of them, and he felt doubly proud. But then he thought back to his own Afghanistan experiences, and he thought about the shots that he'd fired at the Taliban, the shots that the Taliban had fired at him and his friends, and about the impact that war had had on him as a person. And at that single point in time, it all came very, very, very close together. His sense of belonging as a soldier, his sense of understanding as a soldier, and what it really meant to him. And it helped him, as he said, when we talked about it afterwards, particularly as he was thinking about his friends. It helped him move beyond a place that he'd been for a long, long time, where he'd been thinking, where the focus had been on him and his injuries, But this is a moment where he was thinking about the other things that had happened to other people and sort of the greater experience of being a soldier. And I think there at that single point in time, I thought there really is something there between military history, archaeology at Waterloo, what it really means to the benefit it can provide to those who have served, and how it can help other people understand what it is that those who have served have done and what they've been through.
Just recently, ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, has given you a grant of nearly £11,000to help further digs. But you, as you say, you need to fundraise. Can you talk through how you basically fund the model of Waterloo Uncovered?
I think funding these days it's a mix. We're very, very grateful to the people who have helped us. I mean, not least the ABF. As you say, they've donated to us again this year. They were one of the real reasons why we were able to get going in the beginning, because they stumped up cash in that very, very first year. So we're forever thankful to them. Not just them, but other organisations like the Armed Forces Covenant, Veterans Foundations. There's a lot of grant giving organisations out there that support us. We also get support from the likes of livery companies, the grocers, the drapers, the glovers even. We have a sponsor, Annington, and we're always looking for more. We also look to individuals to help spread the word and support our work. We have a number of major donors who are very, very generous. This year in particular, though, what we are looking for, we're actually looking for 100 champions to come and take up the cause. We're supporting, as I said, 100 serving personnel and veterans this year. And we're looking for 100 people to pledge to either raise or donate £500 towards the cost of a veteran being supported by Waterloo Uncovered. Our support, as I say, it's 12 months round. It's not just a trip away. It's year-round support that really makes a difference. So if anyone would like to learn more about our work or learn more about becoming a champion, then I'd certainly direct them to ask them to look at our website, which is www.waterloouncovered.com. It's www.waterlooncovered.com, where they can find more details. And we would welcome their support and their interest in the project, because we rely on the goodwill of people to help us help those who need it most.
Rachel, if you had to sum up Waterloo Uncovered, what does it mean to you?
A new lease of life.
Sure.
Friendship. The ability to carry on. And Waterloo Uncovered's always been there to help me.
Mark Evans, Professor Tony Pollard, Sean Douglas, Rachel Willis and Charles Fournet, thank you very much for being my guests on General Talk for Waterloo Uncovered. Thank you.
And my thanks to everyone at Waterloo Uncovered. To become a champion or learn more about their work, please visit waterloouncovered.com. And to read about how ABF supports their work, visit thesoldierscharity.org. Join me in the next edition of General Talk, a Platinum Jubilee special, as we raise a toast to Her Majesty the Queen for 70 glorious years on the throne. And I interview pageant master extraordinaire Sir Michael Parker about winkles, fireworks and elephants and just about everything else that can go wrong at a Jubilee celebration. Until then, from me, Harry Bucknell, it's farewell and thank you for listening. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers' Charity.